Welcome back to Last Week in Medicine. I'm Stephen Jenkins, and today we are joined by a returning guest from the University of Utah Hospital, Dr. Mita Hoppenfeld. Welcome back, Dr. Hoppenfeld.
Hi, good to be here.
And we're also very lucky today to have a special guest, medical educator and nephrologist, Dr. Joel M. Topf. Welcome to the Last Week in Medicine podcast, Dr. Topf.
Hey, thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
So many of our listeners will recognize Dr. Topf. He's ubiquitous in medical education, social media world. He's a prolific tweeter under the Twitter handle Kidney Boy, and he's a co-founder of the Nephrology Journal Club on Twitter, as well as host and founder of the Nephrology Journal Club podcast, Freely Filtered. He's also the host of a podcast called Channel Your Enthusiasm, which is a deep dive monthly recap of a nephrology textbook, Clinical Physiology of Acid Base and Electrolyte Disorders by Dr. Burton Rose, who I learned incidentally is also the founder of UpToDate.
Heard
Yeah.
Vaguely familiar, very vaguely.
Visited that website a couple times. So Dr. Topf is perhaps most famous for being the chief of nephrology at Cashlack Memorial, the fictional hospital associated with the Curbsiders podcast. He's been a guest multiple times on that podcast and covered a lot of nephrology topics, including hyponatremia, hypernatremia, and renal tubular acidosis. He's written and edited multiple books, including The Fluid, Electrolyte, and Acid Base Companion, which he wrote with fellow future nephrologist Dr. Sarah Faubel when he was a medicine pediatrics resident. I'm not sure how you found time to write a book as a resident. What was that like?
Well, they give you 2 weeks off every year.
Yeah. So generous. And I
Well,
guess it was that book that was that the book that inspired you to become a nephrologist?
yeah. You know how medicine is that the more you learn about any one topic, the more interesting that topic gets. And so you need to be, and I wasn't kind of aware of this potential trap when I started investigating electrolytes. And before I knew it, it was the only thing I was interested in, and I was destined to be a nephrologist.
right on. Well, I did download a copy of that book last year from your website, and I used it when I was teaching medical students specifically about hyponatremia and fluid compartments last year. So definitely worth downloading for our listeners. Also, Dr. Topf is co-editor of the fourth edition of Nephrology Secrets and the first edition of the Handbook of Critical Care Nephrology. Notably, he received the Robert G. Nairns Award from the American Society of Nephrology in 2017 and the Innovation in Kidney Education Award in 2022. So it's a real honor to have you join us today. What did I
Thank
miss?
you. Oh, those that was a that was quite an introduction. I want to meet this Joel Toff guy. He sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. So you practice in Detroit, Michigan, is that right?
Yeah, I grew up in Detroit. I kind of did a tour of the Midwest with my training in Indiana, then University of Chicago, and then came back home and literally live a mile and a half from where I grew up. My kids went to the same elementary school as I did.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Wow.
And
Yeah, they're no
you
longer elementary kids now. Kids are now in college. So.
Yeah. Are any of them going to be nephrologists?
No, I had a pair of twins, and neither of them have any interest in medicine.
Yeah.
Like even a little bit. It is a and I don't, you know, whatever. Everybody's got to pursue their own career. I just kind of I don't know anything else about the world besides medicine, and I feel like I'm ill-equipped to help them make decisions. If they chose medicine, I could have given them good advice, but you
Yeah,
know.
yeah. You know, it's funny. My boys are the same way. They have zero interest in being doctors. One of them's like, I'm going to be an engineer. The other one wants to be like a history professor. I'm like, good luck.
My daughter wants to be a firefighter ballerina, so I'm not sure how to do that. Though I tell people, like, you know, when you go to medical school, it's learning a whole new language. So I feel like I lose words for other language and other aspects of my life. Like I had a whole career before medicine that I was doing, and now I'm like, oh, I don't really remember any of that. And par for the course, I feel like. I have to tell you, Dr. Topf, that book, the Fluid and Electrolytes book, is the most readable book that I have for like hyponatremia. I've referenced it for quite a while, and I didn't recognize you until I was like, wait a second, that name sounds familiar when I was listening to the Curbsider. So have to say, super readable book, very approachable.
I am so happy to hear that. I love that book. That book is it means a lot to me. And the fact that people are still using it, like the book came out in 1999, and it's amazing that it still lands.
It yeah. really, it's very well explained. So I 10 out of 10 recommend. It's on my favorites list in my Kindle book PDF.
Oh, nice. Well, the reason that we invited you on the podcast today is because you were a co-author on a very interesting paper that came out March 23rd in the journal NEJM Evidence about hyponatremia.
Yeah. Here's my question. Just right up from that. So it's NEJM Evidence, New England Journal of Medicine Evidence. Had you ever heard of this journal before this article?
Oh, yeah. No, it's been around for about a year now, right?
So. Okay. Yeah, it's new. I had not heard of this thing. And I remember getting the letter of acceptance, or just when we were applying, I was like, oh, NEJM. Oh, NEJM Evidence. What is that? Or it was just.
Yeah. No, I mean, they post pretty good stuff on there. So I've been perusing it ever since it came out.
Cool.
It took a while for my institution to buy a license to it, though. So it took me a while before I could get like full copies of everything. But yeah, no. So saw your paper that popped up on there. It's all about, you know, the risk of osmotic demyelination syndrome with hyponatremia. So just curious how you got involved in this research question in this project.
The senior author, Michael Frelick, is a person whose career I've been following with quite a bit of interest for a while. And he's on Twitter, and when I've pulled his articles, I've tagged him when I mentioned the articles, I've asked him questions on direct messaging, and we just kind of had a collegial relationship. And then he cold emailed me one day. He says, I'm doing this paper on osmotic demyelinating syndrome and hyponatremia. Would you be interested? And I think this was about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was like, sure, I'm interested. And a lot of, you know, and I really am just kind of, you know, I'm not trying to walk away from the paper, but the reality is I was an advisor during a lot of it. They had questions mm-hmm. about how they should approach hyponatremia, how should they define it, these types of things. And I, you know, gave them advice kind of throughout that, read early drafts of the protocol, read early drafts of the paper. And so, you know, I was not a researcher. I helped build that. I did a lot of background work. But that's kind of my role.
Mm-hmm. No, very cool that collaboration though came out of your work on Twitter. Cause I think that's what I love most about Med Twitter is that, you know, you can interact with all of these different physicians and researchers around the world so easily, right? Like, you could just tag them in a post and you know, make that connection. So that's very cool.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the best arguments to get involved in whichever social media at the moment. I don't know if Twitter is going to last. It had a kind of an embarrassing moment today with Ron DeSantis announcing.
Yeah, yeah. That was about as perfect as it could have been. Yeah, it was a good metaphor for a lot of things, I think. But
yeah, so but I think that what we have found is that this type of communication among scientific professionals and medical professionals is super useful. And whether it happens on Twitter or some other front end, the need for it's going to continue. I think it is really positive.
So I think. You know, this osmotic demyelination syndrome, we kind of learn it about it in medical school. It's a very rare complication. And kind of the teaching has always been that, you know, the biggest risk factor is if you correct somebody's hyponatremia too quickly. And I think that I always just assumed that was settled science. Was that your impression before being involved in this project?
Well, I mean, I've been teaching this forever, right? And so... and I remember when we were writing the fluid and electrolyte book, we pulled some of the research on it, and there was a lot of animal studies, and the animal studies seemed to work. But as my career goes on and years and decades gone on, so I finished my residency, my fellowship in 2003. So I'm 20 years as a attending nephrologist. And throw on 8 years before that as in multiple residencies and fellowships. And I still have never seen a case of osmotic demyelinating syndrome. Never.
I guess that's very fortunate, right?
Well, so my so have you seen it? Have you seen a case?
I have never seen a case. I have not been practicing as long as you. But yeah, no, it's thankfully a very rare complication.
I feel like we talk about it all. I feel like we talk about it all.
I talk about it and I worry about it endlessly. And I will tell you that I have seen I've seen a lot of patients. I've seen a lot of hyponatremia mismanaged, right? And what really brought this home to me is the European hyponatremia guidelines. There's really two guidelines out there for hyponatremia. There's an American group, lead author is Verbalis, and then there's this an endocrine ICU collaboration from Europe. I like the European guidelines. They have a very straightforward algorithm for dealing with hyponatremia. They do not require you to do any math, which I think is very helpful. They have kind of fixed doses of hypertonic saline rather than calculating rates. It simplifies it. And that's the one that I teach the residents about. And it's actually a great clinical guideline. You know, it's like, whatever, they're like 50 pages and it's really well-researched, well-written. And I actually have my fellows read the whole guideline. And we actually have that as a didactic section where they go home, they read the guideline, and then we talk through the whole thing. And they usually love it because it gives a lot of background behind it. But in the section on ODS, they claim that they've pulled every single article on it and they found 58 cases. And I was like, what? And there's some, there's, you know, the guidelines are old. They came out in 2014 and they didn't go beat, but they went only from 1997 to 2014. So it was like 20, whatever. It was close to 20 years and they found 58 published cases. And I was like, what's going on? This is the most common electrolyte abnormality, you know, somewhere between, depending on the reference you're looking at, anywhere from 20 to 40% of inpatients are going to develop hyponatremia. How could it only be 58 cases? And then I started thinking, well, I've never seen a case. And I started talking to my partners and they'd never seen a case. And I was like, wow, I see this drug, I see hyponatremia mismanaged all the time. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a case. My partners have never seen a case. There's only 58 cases reported in the literature. This is a lot rarer than I had been led to believe.
Sure. But it's so catastrophic that you definitely don't want to cause it, right? But yeah, super rare.
No, that's right. And it became one of these things I was like, and I didn't know, it was one of the things I didn't want to say it too loudly, right? I didn't want people to ignore this and miss, and maybe the reason we're seeing so few cases is we're doing our best we can to manage it. I will tell you, I think, there have been, you know, and that was, you know, again, that's 2014. And in 2018, there's this article that comes out from Pennsylvania. It's the George study. I think it's about 1,200 patients, and they found 25 cases. I think it was 25 cases out of 1,200. And that was a much higher rate of ODS than I had certainly experienced in my career and expected from what I had known before, but that kind of bumped up the risk and made it seem more reasonable. But when the call came from Frelick, I was very prone. I was like, oh, this seems like something that really should be investigated. Like we should have good epidemiologic data on this. And so the hook that Frelick had is they had access to an inpatient database. It's called the Gemini database. And it's a database of every admission to it for an internal medicine patient, excluded ICU patients. But if the patient went into the ICU and then ended up on the on the floor, it was then included in the database. So it seems pretty comprehensive. Mm-hmm. I suppose patients could die in the ICU and then they wouldn't be included. And patients that came to the ER and were discharged from the ER would not be included. And I suppose I can't imagine that a surgery service would accept a hyponatremia that was pretty significant. Seems unlikely, regardless of what's going on.
Yeah, that's an easy block for them.
Yeah, right. It's exactly. And yeah. So, you know, I guess it's possible, but it felt very comprehensive and they tied together most of the hospitals and most, if not all, the hospitals in Toronto. So pretty comprehensive database, good epidemiologic slice. And let's take a look and see how much hyponatremia there is. We captured in this study everybody for 10 years that had a sodium less than 130 on admission. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of exclusions. We excluded people with blood sugars greater than 450. We excluded people with blood sugar with a diagnosis of diabetes insipidus. And that wasn't that much. And then we ended up with 22,000 cases of hyponatremia less than 130. And this is by far the largest epidemiologic study on hyponatremia ever done, of hospitalized hyponatremia. There is, you know, NHANES looks at the entire country of the United States, and they've reported on hyponatremia. But we're not, that's not what we're talking about. We're really talking about hospitalized patients.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked at, you know, what was their hospital course, you know, what was their outcome? You know, mainly we were in the outcome we were interested in is ODS, is osmotic demyelinating syndrome. And we're looking for radiologic evidence or a definitive clinical diagnosis. So if they got coded as ODS, we're going to call it. Otherwise, we're looking at CT scans and MRIs. We did keyword searches. If they were positive for a keyword searches, we would pull the radiologic exam and then judge it as unlikely, possibly definite. And possibly indefinites were what we included in our ODS cohort. And that, and then, you know, the top line result is that was 12 cases of ODS out of 20,000 cases of hyponatremia. And that's kind of eye popping. That's 0.05%. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's non-existent, right? It is, it, you know, 12 out of 20,000 is just like, wow, we're doing a lot of interventions and a lot of measuring of sodiums and a lot of ICU admissions for very few bad outcomes. And I want to put on the other side of that, we had a very high rate of mismanagement, right? Sodium's correcting too fast. I want to say that came out to 18% overall.
Yeah. That made me feel a lot better, honestly, when I saw that. And I think I highlighted it in bright pink because I was like, this makes me feel a lot better about what we're doing. Because I'll come in overnight and I'll be like, oh my God, the sodium is so high suddenly. Makes me feel better.
Right. No. Yeah, that's right. And my heart drops whenever that happens. But I want to say in the George study, now the George was a little bit different. They looked at patients only with sodium. This is the one from
Pennsylvania.
This is the one from Pennsylvania. They looked at 1,500 patients and they were all with sodiums less than 120. Okay. Mm-hmm. They had 41% of patients correct too fast. And then if you broke down our 18% and you looked at patients with sodiums between 110 and 120, it was 46% overcorrected. And if less than 110, it was 70% overcorrected. So as their risk of ODS goes up because their sodium is going down,
yeah,
their risk of overcorrection was really, really accelerating.
And that's just, I mean, that has to do with the physiology, though, of why they're so low in the first place, right? Like they're the highest risk to correct quickly. If you get even like a little bit of saline in the emergency room, they might shoot up. You know, if you have like
it
these,
depends. It's highly dependent on the.
It definitely depends, right?
I would, in my experience, where do I get the super low sodiums? A lot of thiazide induced, and those uh-huh. respond to saline way too briskly. Those are the terrifying ones to take care of. But then there's a lot of the other ones that I see are the SIADH.
Right.
They also get very low, and they don't respond very quickly. Those are the ones you're going to have to pump them full of 3% to raise their sodium.
Yeah, they might even go down if you give them saline.
And that's right. And they may go down if you give them saline. And boy, that'll get that. Nothing freaks out the ER more than that. And I'll tell you, I haven't seen tea and toast that low. Those typically kind of end up in the mid-teens for me. That's the ones that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
And then I'll tell you the other thing that I see a lot of is kind of mixed etiology.
Sure.
Where there's it's like a volume depletion on top of an SIADH. And so they'll be super low, like 108, and they'll have this brisk response up to like 118 with saline. You're like, oh my God, this thing's going to super overcorrect. And then you can't budge them.
Yeah.
They're stuck at 118. And I've not seen that characterized in the literature, but boy, I think that has been a common phenotype for me with these kind of real low ones is like, wow, it sure seemed like volume depletion to begin with, but it's not behaving that way anymore.
Yeah.
And those patients can be frustrating. And so, you know, we kind of broke down the, those 12 cases of ODS. Now, one of the things that happened when we designed the study, we we went through, you know, we had kind of built some ethical guidelines. And one of them, when you're doing these chart reviews, is if, you know, if you get a too small of a group, you can't characterize it. No, you can't be real specific. And our line in the sand was groups less than five.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were capturing 20,000 people, we didn't think that would be meaningful. But all of a sudden, our ODS group was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not able to publish kind of the result you want to see, which is like of those 12, how many of them were rapid correctors and how many of them were not? And that we can't disclose that because that those numbers, one of those numbers is under five, right?
but you did you were able to report, though, I think it was seven of the 12 patients did not have rapid correction based on the table, right?
We did report that. You can see how we're working around it. We're following our ethical guidelines, but you know the table you're looking for, and it's not there. You're mm-hmm. looking for the data disclosed specifically by that. But yeah, so you're looking at table one?
Table two.
It's table two. Thank you.
Yeah. It's in there. It's the, you have the seven for the less than 8 millimoles per liter.
Yes. And then less than or equal to 5 for the, mm-hmm. for the other groups.
And that, I mean, that kind of is a mind-blowing result, though, in and of itself, because we always, almost always associate ODS with rapid correction. But if you're telling me that of this minuscule number of patients who actually got ODS, at least half of them were managed appropriately and did not rapidly correct, and they still got it, that kind of like disrupts the whole dogma, right?
It is. One of the things that's weird about that is we stopped measuring and stopped caring when the sodium went over 130. Mm-hmm. And I know in my hands, I stopped. I mean, I actually stopped quite a bit before that. Once I get over 125, I'm way less concerned about speed of recovery. And I kind of let the teams, you know, go hog wild and get that patient discharged. In this cohort, though, three of the patients ended up progressing to hypernatremia.
Yeah.
Three of those patients had ended up getting ODS. And so that ends, and we did not anticipate that when we did the study design. And so this is it's an area where it does add some gray thing, because it does look like mm-hmm. there may have been an osmotic influence in this group that we consider, you know, because they didn't correct faster than that for their hyponatremia. But after the hyponatremia, they still had an osmotic insult with going to hypernatremia.
Yeah.
That does it.
I was going to say, that's the part that I have pulled up, and I literally wrote next to it, weird, I wouldn't think that, on page 4, where you have that, where there was a prolonged period of hypernatremia in such patients after correction of hyponatremia. And that was my big question, is I wanted to know why you thought that happened. Was it just a second osmotic insult, or there's something?
It's still, I mean, again, you know, we don't report on all the patients that develop hypernatremia, is just these few that we were drilling down on because they had this ODS.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how common that is. That was not part of our study design. We really focused on hyponatremia. And, you know, you have limited resources, and we're like, well, once sodium is over 130, we're kind of done here. And I think that's kind of how most people act in the hospital in terms of managing hyponatremia. I don't know what was going on with these patients that they developed such severe hypernatremia going on afterwards. And honestly, you know, these are the kind of limitations you run in when you do an electronic database, you know, biopsy of 20,000 patients, is that, you know, you get breath, but you don't get death. So
I guess,
it is intriguing. I am not willing to throw the osmotic insult philosophy or theory for hyponatremia, for ODS, under the bus. I think mm-hmm. this is interesting data. I think the top line result that we need to look at, and that I think is pretty compelling, is this is very rare.
Right.
This and is an incredibly rare complication. What we found as the most important risk factor was just the degree of hyponatremia, right? Like, I know we've been focusing all on the change in sodium, but boy, how severe that hyponatremia is really should be waking you up. That if the percentage of patients that developed this complication dramatically rose as that sodium fell below 110.
Yeah, I think the rate was 2.6% if you had a sodium less than 110.
Overall, that's right. And when you look at the overall cohort of 0.05%, that is a massive magnification.
Yeah. And there were other risk factors you guys confirmed too, like, you know, coming in with a positive alcohol level, having hypokalemia. Those were also more common in the folks who had ODS. And those are risk factors that have been previously proposed.
Previously identified. Absolutely. And again, right. And it's one of those, it is interesting. Like, why is it that the potassium, like the easy thing to reach for is that the low potassium is part of raising the sodium very high. Cause right. Literally for the, you know, according to the Edelson formula, giving potassium is just like giving sodium. And we give potassium without even thinking about it to these patients because they sometimes have profound hypokalemia. You're giving 20, 40, 60, 80 milliequivalents a day. I mean, 80 milliequivalents of potassium, which I wouldn't blink an eye with a potassium of 2.8 or 2.6, is a half a liter of normal saline equivalents. And I would be freaked if somebody just was throwing around boluses of normal saline like that. And so, but we don't know, right? Like that's just pushing that hypokalemia back into the sodium box as the cause of ODS. But
yeah,
you know, I feel like it also
could be a signal of, you know, this person could be malnourished, right? This could be someone who's got low solute intake and it, you know, like the beer potomania type person or the tea and toast type person. Like you also found that, you know, the people with ODS had an average lower urine osm, which if you have a sodium that low and your urine osm is also super low, you know, it's a pretty small group of diagnoses that cause that. Those are people right. that are tough to manage because they often correct quickly. But it,
those are people that are on the road to rapid correction.
Yeah.
But once again, what you're doing there is you are trying to force our findings into this ODS framework that we had previously understood. And it may be true. Maybe the ODS framework is true. But I think going through this study, I feel like maybe we don't know as much about this condition as we think we do. Because the causal relationship, boy, seems loose. We saw a lot of mismanagement and we had a very rare complication rate.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's worthwhile looking broader. And I will, and consistently, way more, you know, consistent finding of hypokalemia being a risk factor, alcohol being a risk factor. Also consistent finding that people are, you know, there's a number of reports of people that, oh, we controlled the sodium rise right along the guidelines and the patient still developed ODS.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we shouldn't be so skeptical of those findings and say, well, that seems to be something that really happens. And it seems to be consistent with some of the other published literature. So,
is this study going to change the way you manage hyponatremia?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I kind of, I did some soul searching and my sense is the only factor, you know, you can't control what the patient's potassium is when they arrive. The potassium is their potassium and you can't control whether they're drunk and you can't control how low the sodium is. The only thing you can control is the rate of correction. And so I don't think it does change what I'm going to do. But the question is, how crazy am I going to go over re-lowering when the patient goes too fast,
mm-hmm.
right? And we spend some energy doing that. And I think to me, maybe I'm a little less enthusiastic about that. You know, again, that's an easy thing to say right now. I know how my heart feels every time that sodium goes up too fast, and I will probably still want to control its, re-lower it. And I think the other thing, when I get that sodium less than 110, I'm gonna be like, ooh, this one really we need to pay attention to. Not that I wasn't before. And again, I don't know if that changes what I'm doing. Though, how much concern should we have about the sodium of 122? Maybe just all we need to do there is prevent it from getting to be 160, prevent the severe hypernatremia on the other side. I think that these are questions that need to be opened. And I think I guess what I would say in kind of my final thoughts on this is that we should have a little bit more humility about what we know about hyponatremia and not pretend that this is settled science, because what we thought was settled science sure doesn't seem to be behaving like the model that we've created, that we get a lot of mismanagement that seems to be innocuous. One of the other things that's not so clear in this study, but in a number of other studies is, a lot of the ODS that we see does not have the devastating permanent neurologic outcomes that I teach and was taught, that there's a lot more recovery going on than we had once thought. And part of that is probably we're MRI doing a lot more MRIs. So we're probably diagnosing a lot more what would have been kind of subclinical or subtle neurologic deficits, and being able to put a finger on it and say, oh, this is due to the rapid change in sodium. And those less severe cases are doing better.
That's good to know. I mean, though, it is nice to know, right? I think that the primary thing that I, as a hospitalist, took away from this article, which I think, for those listeners that are planning on reading it, there are, I think about readability of articles whenever I look at them. This is a readable article, a very approachable article. The sodium things that I feel comfortable saying, okay, this is consistent with what I already know, even though the number is really small, is I'll be a lot more nervous when that sodium is in sort of that 110 to 115-ish range, where it's like, should this patient go to the ICU? Can they come to the medicine floor? How are we feeling about that? So I feel a little bit more like, okay, this maybe adds some information to me with regards to that. And then bolsters my perspective of the less than 110 makes me nervous. And I've always been worried about dehydration. Dehydration has been lumped into the category of these people overcorrect, think about the thiazides. And it's good to see, sort of as you outlined, or as y'all outlined in table one, the urine sodium of less than 30 combined with the urine osms and serum osms really supporting dehydration as a sort of a risk factor in this very small N of ODS makes me feel a lot better of saying, cool, I am worried about dehydration really correcting. So I think risk stratifying patients in my head from this paper is the primary thing that I'm gonna take from it. And also the really clear awareness of the fact that this is a rare diagnosis, and one where I'm like, this isn't how I was taught in medical school, which I feel like is so much of what we learn through our practice and through residency, where I'm like, oh, I learned all this stuff, but is it really just fake news or news that still is yet to be firmly established? So I thought this was helpful for that.
Yeah, I think this is a field that is crying out for interventional trials. Like everything we know about this, about hyponatremia, is done from retrospective analysis. And, one of the things, do you guys use DDAVP clamps in Utah?
In the ICU, they'll use them, but we don't use them on the floor because we can't give hypertonic saline on the floor at our hospital.
No, we're right there with you. We can do it in the step down unit. So we can do hypertonic saline through peripherals, and we can do them in the step down units, which is probably appropriate. And this is kind of what I am teaching my fellows, is to use the clamp. The big paper that supports the use of the clamp is, I think it had 50 patients in it. 50 retrospective patients in it. And they're like,
wow.
And they're very excited that they had no cases of ODS, and they were all in the sodiums in the 110s. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, you could have done anything with sodiums in the mid 116 if you're just gonna have 50 patients. It's just so rare.
Right. That you could never do anything. You could never power a trial to actually show, any change in ODS probably. But I do think you're right. Like you say, we should be more humble about hyponatremia. And I think of hyponatremia as, it usually does humble me, because it never plays like it's supposed to, right? Like you do all the numbers and the calculations, and you do your your urine electrolytes and your physical exam, and you think you understand what's going on, and you enact some plan, and it almost never goes according to plan, right? So I think some interventional trials on like doing a head-to-head with the clamp would be a great study, and it would probably be a pretty easy study to do, right? You wouldn't have to have huge numbers to show that it works.
I mean, perspective would be interesting. There's been, the retrospective data on DDAVP, it's not great, right? Most of the DDAVP that is deployed in hyponatremia is used in rescue. It's the, went too fast, let's reverse.
Yeah.
And in fact, in our study here, in the Gemini study here, we did find that use of DDAVP, like ICU admission, was associated with more ODS, that the ODS patients had a higher rate of use of DDAVP and a higher rate of ICU admission. I think that really just reflects their sodiums were lower. They were probably in rescue. They were probably overcorrected and they were trying to rescue, pull it back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but when we've looked at it in other studies, we see that it prolongs hospitalization and it's not clear what kind of net benefit we're having. It's something that makes sense to use. It's something that I teach my fellows to do. I think it makes sense, but
it's also physiologically elegant. You know, it's kind of, it's nice to use physiology.
It is, but how many times in medicine have we been burnt when we say the physiology makes sense? And then when we finally do the study, it was like, oh, that didn't work out at all like we expected.
Yeah, you know? Like the No Stone trial. I don't know.
I'm podcasting on that tomorrow.
Oh, can I get your hot take on that one? What did you think of that study? Or is that too much of a conversation?
I think that study is long overdue, and I really think that also should humble the stone community, which has been highly dependent on doing 24-hour urines and just doing urine chemical analysis of the urine and saying we won when we kind of reduced the supersaturation for calcium, you know, by lowering urine calcium, and like, well, it's more complex than that because they were successful at lowering the supersaturation of calcium, but they were not able to show a reduction of total stones. There's some subtleties in that study, and it'll be fun to talk about. So tune into Freely Filtered.
We'll be Freely Filtered for that.
Coming up soon. We got a couple of good stone experts. It should be a fun discussion. Yeah. That said, I've not stopped my thiazide use in my stone patients, right? Because most of the stone.
My next question: Do you still give the thiazide diuretic? But I guess
I do. But I don't think anybody who's serious about stones uses hydrochlorothiazide.
Oh,
that's
are the they using chlorthalidone or?
Chlorthalidone or indapamide.
Indapamide, okay.
Something with very long half-life. And so I think there are some interesting secondary findings in that study. It's going to be a fun discussion.
Well, it's a good teaser. Yeah. Everyone, make sure you listen to that one.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, thanks so much, Dr. Topf, for coming on and talking about this paper with us. We know you're a man in high demand, so we'll let you get back to the rest of your evening.
This was great. Thank you for the invitation. It was actually kind of fun to talk about this. I had a good time.
Awesome. No, thanks so much. It was nice to meet you.
Take care.
Cool. Well, should we hop into the next portion of our podcast? This is going to be a long one, so everyone buckle in. You know, we had a very nice 45 minutes with Dr. Topf, who is an expert, and now you get to listen to a couple amateurs talk about some more papers. So the first paper that I'm going to talk about is published in the same journal, NEJM Evidence, May 6, 2023. This was apixaban or warfarin in patients with On-X mechanical aortic valves. First author was Dr. Tracy Wang from Duke University School of Medicine. So I think most people are aware or familiar with the fact that warfarin is the standard of care for mechanical valves still. So, which is kind of a bummer because warfarin is a pain of a drug sometimes, but every time we've looked at alternatives like DOACs, so there was a 2013 study called Realign, where they looked at dabigatran, which is a direct thrombin inhibitor, versus warfarin in mechanical or aortic, mechanical aortic or mitral valves. They had to stop that one early because there were higher rates of thromboembolism and bleeding in the dabigatran arm. So that was a big flop. And since then, you know, we've just stuck with warfarin for mechanical valves. Well, then they came out with this ONX valve, which is designed to have a lower risk of thrombosis. So they actually have these flared inlets on the inflow area that are supposed to reduce turbulence. You have these leaflet guards on the outflow rim that protect the leaflets when they're closed. And then the ONX valve is in the aortic position, which is just a lower risk area than the mitral valve, right? You have more blood flow, so you're less likely to have clots form. And so there's actually an interesting study, the PROACT study, that looked at using a lower INR goal for the ONX valve. They looked at INR 1.5 to 2 versus 2 to 3 plus low-dose aspirin in this valve, and they found similar rates of thrombosis and thromboembolism and lower rates of bleeding. So that was considered a positive study, and it's been incorporated into clinical practice guidelines, including the AHA, which recommends this lower INR target in ONX valves as a reasonable strategy. So that's kind of the background on ONX valves. But the question for this study was, can we use apixaban, which is a factor 10A inhibitor? And it's awesome, right? Like, we love apixaban. Like, if I could have such a great drug, you know, they wanted to see, is it as good or non-inferior to warfarin in preventing valve thrombosis and thromboembolism in people with these ONX mechanical aortic valves? So they did a prospective randomized open label trial. They enrolled adults who'd had their ONX mechanical valve for at least 3 months because, and this is true for the lower INR goal too, you have to have the normal INR goal for 3 months, 2 to 3, before you can drop down to that 1.5 to 2. So they had these guys on warfarin for 3 months with the normal goal. They had them take aspirin, 81 milligrams daily, and they randomized them to either apixaban, 5 milligrams twice a day, or warfarin with a goal of 2 to 3. So they went with the traditional INR goal. And their primary efficacy endpoint was a composite of valve thrombosis or thromboembolism like a stroke. And the non-inferiority margin that they set was 1.75% per patient year. But they also looked at whether apixaban provides acceptable anticoagulation based on the objective performance criterion, which is OPC set by the FDA for mechanical valves. And that number is 1.6% per patient year. So they thought, you know, we'd like to see if it's as good as warfarin, but we also just want to see if this is something the FDA would approve based on this number they have. The primary safety endpoint they looked at was major bleeding. So they estimated that they would need 990 patients to show non-inferiority. After enrolling 863 patients, the Data Safety Monitoring Board recommended stopping the trial early because of a higher rate of thromboembolic events in the apixaban arm, which is just tragic. so, you know.
Yeah, this felt a little bit like the rivaroxaban trial with the for APLAS, where it was like, yay, this could be so exciting for people, mm-hmm. because otherwise they're stuck on Coumadin forever. Yeah, but it's nice to see if we could potentially have people be on something other than Coumadin. It seemed like this wasn't the case here, very clearly. I thought it was interesting. Whenever I look at non-inferiority trials, I always look at non-inferiority margins. Like, how are they defining it? Like, mm-hmm. Is a doubling of event rate, which is what they have, a doubling of event rate reasonable? So even if this was something where you could potentially use apixaban, I was trying to think about the patient population that I would select, like, as a patient, if I would select to be on apixaban over Coumadin with a risk of a, you know, close to double serious event rate.
It would probably just have to be a patient with like severe contraindication to a warfarin, right? Like someone who just cannot take warfarin. For whatever reason, maybe they're just really bad at getting their INRs checked or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, to accept this high rate. So if you look at the numbers here, they had 20 events in the apixaban arm, which was 4.2% per patient year, versus 6 in the warfarin, which was 1.3% per patient year. So you know, that was a difference of 2.9%. They definitely didn't meet that margin for non-inferiority. And even if they had gone to 990 patients, there was no statistical way they could get there. And then, you know, when you look at this OPC criteria set by the FDA, they weren't even close for that. And then breaking down the actual events, they had 3 valve thromboses and 14 strokes in the apixaban arm, as well as 2 deaths that were related to valve-related thromboembolism, versus 5 transient ischemic attacks and 1 myocardial infarction in the warfarin group. So like the types of events were also worse in the apixaban arm. And like you commented, you know, it was kind of like the rivaroxaban trial for APS. There's been a couple of those. And yeah, it's interesting. They always show that the DOACs are worse when it comes to arterial stuff, right? Because in those studies, you know, it actually, DOACs did okay at preventing venous thromboembolism. But when you're on the arterial side, it's like, for whatever reason, the DOACs just do not seem to have the juice that you need, right? So warfarin always comes out on top. So bleeding rates were lower in apixaban compared to the warfarin. But you had, you know, 3 hemorrhagic strokes in apixaban, and so, you know, things like that, not great. So I think the take home message for this study is that we're not going to be using DOACs in mechanical valves, even this Onyx valve, which is supposed to have a lower risk of thrombosis, we're going to stick with warfarin, which is going to keep, you know, the warfarin thrombosis clinic in business.
Yeah, I got to say, the one thing I did like about this study is if they had used rivaroxaban, I would still have the question of like, well, if you'd used a DOAC that maybe was a little smoother, had a sort of consistent levels in the blood, would you have a different outcome? And they use sort of, I guess, what I consider a gold standard DOAC. So I don't really have a question in my head anymore. So,
yeah, I think this, you know, this is a great example of why we got to do the studies. You know, people can say it's a nice, you know, it's nice to try using DOACs in people off label, but you got to do the studies like this to see if you're actually harming people. And there's other indications for anticoagulation out there where we still don't know if DOACs are safe, and no one's done the big studies to see, right? Like heparin induced thrombocytopenia. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that you can use DOACs. People are using DOACs, but no one's done the big prospective study. Same thing for like LV thrombus. There's like little randomized controlled trials out there, but nothing big that, you know, is confirming DOACs are safe. So we got to get those studies done.
Yeah.
So you're going to do the next paper. I'll let you introduce it.
Yeah, sure. I'll pop it up right now. So hypotension avoidance versus hypertension avoidance strategies in non-cardiac surgery. This was published in Annals of Internal Medicine. And it's super cool because a lot of hospital medicine, a lot of primary care medicine is perioperative care and trying to answer the question of perioperative care, what drugs to hold, what drugs to not hold. So this is, I think, called the POISE 2 trial. So essentially, I will say, when I did 1 year of an anesthesia residency, and part of the learning that I had in perioperative medicine is you hold the ACE, you hold the ARB before surgery because you want to avoid the hypotension. And, you know, subjectively, I did see that, you know, you induce someone and they fall asleep and all of a sudden, you know, they've taken their ARB and their blood pressure goes down pretty dramatically. You've got the vasopressin ready just to kind of boost them back up. So I thought this trial was super interesting. Now in hospital medicine, right, I'm trying to decide, what do I do about people's blood pressure medicine beforehand. So basically the objective of this trial was to compare the effects of avoiding hypotension intraoperatively and postoperatively versus sort of avoiding hypertension intraoperatively and postoperatively in non-cardiac surgery. They had a primary outcome of a composite of vascular death, non-fatal myocardial infarction after non-cardiac surgery, stroke, and cardiac arrest at 30 days. Their primary intervention was if you were trying to avoid hypotension, so low blood pressure, before surgery and 2 days after surgery, they wouldn't give you your blood pressure meds, and they'd hold them, with the exception of following some algorithm of if your blood pressure was very high, they would give you like a PRN dose of your blood pressure medicine. And for hypertension avoidance, so avoiding high blood pressure, they would give you all of your blood pressure medications day of surgery and then continue them on postoperatively. So the paper itself was fun to read because I thought it was pretty cool. I'll just go through some of the highlights of it. Ultimately, the question that they really are trying to answer is like, which one of these things is better in preventing these terrible outcomes? So one thing I thought was interesting was going down to sort of their statistical analysis. They talk about the baseline outcome rate for these really bad outcomes as being 11% in the literature, which is not something I really knew, that after non-cardiac surgery for patients that they enrolled in this trial for their study participants that were older and had known cardiovascular disease, who were undergoing inpatient non-cardiac surgery, they had an 11% vascular outcome rate at baseline. So that's kind of terrifying to me as a hospitalist who takes care of a lot of these patients.
Seems pretty high, yeah.
So basically what they wanted to do was to see, they thought that avoiding hypotension, so preventing low blood pressure in people, would have a 25% better outcome than the hypertension group. So they basically had 6,500 patients that they enrolled. They had two categories. They split them pretty evenly. So one where they're avoiding low blood pressure and one where they're trying to avoid high blood pressure. And they sort of estimated that 6,500 patients would provide them a 95% power to detect a hazard ratio of 0.75. With this 11% outcome rate in the avoiding hypertension strategy group. So whenever I look at power studies, I like to break it down. Basically, they said, if you have 6,500 patients and you believe that they have a base rate from the data of 11%, that's their baseline event rate in the hypertension avoidance group, then if a 25% relative risk reduction in the hypotension, so low blood pressure avoidance group, was real, then you'd be able to reject the null hypothesis that there was no difference between the groups 95% of the time. So I thought that was pretty cool, pretty interesting. Ultimately, the issues that they had with this was they had a lot of people who accidentally took their blood pressure medication, or they sort of crossed over. All of it ended up in a wash because they did an intention to treat analysis and it was sort of a real world study. And their ultimate outcome was that fewer patients in the hypotension avoidance group. So trying to avoid low blood pressure and not giving your blood pressure medications the day before surgery and 2 days before surgery had any real difference when compared to the patients who just got their blood pressure medications. So I thought that was kind of interesting, because I would have expected that if you had really tried to, you know, avoid low blood pressure intraoperatively, and if you had really tried to avoid low blood pressure postoperatively, then you would actually have, you know, fewer vascular outcomes, but they didn't really see a significant difference, which was interesting. One thing that they did note that was kind of cool was that the duration of hypotension, so the duration of postoperative hypotension in other studies, has been shown to be associated with poor vascular outcomes, but they didn't really see any difference here between postoperative, intraoperative and postoperative hypotension when they held the blood pressure medications. The primary thing that they saw was during surgery, people had in the hypotension avoidance group, so trying to keep their blood pressure low, had some clinically significant hypotension. When they were trying to avoid hypertension, so intraoperatively, they had lower blood pressures that were clinically significant, required vasopressors, but this didn't really seem to contribute to the outcomes. So all in all, saying hypertension and hypotension is very hard. But what the main point that you take away from the study was that it doesn't really seem to matter if you hold their blood pressure medications beforehand or you give them to them. Patients don't seem to have worse outcomes. And holy cow, an 11% base rate for vascular outcomes is terrifying.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think like you pointed out, really the only difference between the groups is that you had a little bit more intraoperative hypotension in the hypertension avoidance group because they had gotten their meds, right?
Yeah.
But it didn't translate into any difference at 30-day outcomes, which were 14% in each group, so even higher than that 11% base rate, right? Like the primary outcome was like 14%. So
Yeah.
that's those are some big numbers, and I think I don't know if anyone's gonna change the guidelines and say take your ACE or your ARB before surgery. It probably has to be individualized, but I think it does maybe help take away some of the fear of, oh no, they got their ACE inhibitor yesterday, we're hosed, surgery is going to be terrible today, or like this. I think you can probably still go ahead and do surgery and they're going to be okay. But if you have someone who's like, super like well controlled all the time, that's probably someone who is more likely to get low during surgery if you if you continue their blood pressure medicine right before surgery, versus like someone who like hardly ever takes their medicine and so their blood pressures are usually like super high. Like it probably doesn't matter as much if those people take their
I don't
meds
know. I mean, like
anyway.
they didn't, it's not
Yeah.
addressed on paper. So it's
Right.
really
Right.
questions still up in the air
Right.
after the phase 3 trial of, hey, look, as a perioperative physician, if someone continues to take their ACE or ARB, they might have intraoperative hypotension, but you've got an anesthesiologist, they've got some vasopressin and phenylephrine, they'll
Yeah.
manage it. And it doesn't really matter in your postoperative state. And it's not really going to affect your poor vascular outcomes. The CAD that you're going in with is what's going to affect it.
Yeah.
We don't really know the characteristics of the patients that have that make up that sort of like 3% difference that you're sort of saying. Who are the ones that are going to have those vascular outcomes? They're not really driven by whether you hold their medicines or not. And
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm taking away from this paper is
Yeah.
that the patients that, I have my clinical gestalt of I should continue your blood pressure medicines, I can feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point too, like managing blood pressure in the hospital is very difficult anyway. And like if you're not an anesthesiologist with access to all these, fun toys and vasopressors and vasodilators with very close monitoring, like the worst thing you could do in the hospital is give someone IV hydralazine, right? But like an anesthesiologist in a controlled setting can get away with, giving some fun medicines. But like if you're just like dealing with their regular standard oral meds, there's not a lot that can be done actually, usually, because it's just so slow acting.
Yeah,
So.
and I mean, and that's something that they comment on in the paper. They talk about the VISION trial, which showed that really only postoperative hypotension was associated with an increased risk for major vascular events. There's a couple confounders there, right? Like the sicker patients are probably going to have postoperative hypotension, but
Yeah.
there's some element of like they also don't have a human being that's there titrating their blood pressure medications very closely and checking their blood pressure every 2 minutes. So I think sort of intraoperatively, this paper helps me feel better that it's a bit of a wash and I should go with my clinical gestalt and look for further studies.
Beauty. I love it. All right. Well, I got one more paper that we're going to blow through here. This was published in JAMA Surgery on May 3rd. The title is Diagnostic Accuracy of Unenhanced Computed Tomography for Evaluation of Acute Abdominal Pain in the Emergency Department. And the first author is Dr. Hiram Sheish from Columbia University in New York. So I think it's generally accepted that CT abdomen with contrast is the best test for acute abdominal pain in most adults who come to the emergency department, especially non-pregnant adults. Contrast is essential for some diagnoses, like active bleeding. It makes it easier to see, cancers and abscesses and things like that. It's not essential for every diagnosis, right? Like kidney stones, it's actually better not to use contrast. But for most patients with undifferentiated acute abdominal pain, we want to give contrast. But sometimes there are circumstances where we're afraid to give contrast, like the patient has poor renal function. And we've talked a lot on this podcast about, contrast-associated acute kidney injury, whether that's real or not. Or the patient might have an allergy to iodinated contrast, like maybe they've had a true hypersensitivity reaction in the past, and so we're afraid to give that person contrast, and rightfully so. But what this paper is getting at is, you know, it's important to understand what the risk of diagnostic error is if we don't give contrast, if we just send them through the donut of truth without giving them IV contrast. You know, we think we're going to get all the answers because we're just simple country internists and the CT scan can tell you anything. But if you're not using contrast, like, what are you missing is kind of what they're trying to get at here. So, and it's a clever study that the way that they do it. So they identify, you know, 200 patients who got dual energy contrast enhanced CT scan for acute abdominal pain at one institution. And they used the actual radiologist report as like a reference standard. And then they had two of the study authors also review all of these contrast enhanced images to come up with what the reference standard is going to be. So they had to have two out of the three readers agree on the presence of an actionable finding. And then that was considered like a true positive. Then they used these dual energy techniques to digitally subtract IV and oral contrast to create a non-enhanced scan. And then they had six blinded radiologists, three faculty and three senior residents, and this is across three different hospitals, review all of these scans without contrast and then record their findings. And so the primary outcome they were looking at was diagnostic accuracy of an unenhanced CT for primary cause of abdominal pain. So could they still see what was causing the patient's abdominal pain on the scan without contrast? And then the secondary outcomes they looked at were the diagnostic accuracy of unenhanced CT for important incidental findings. So were there other things on that scan, like, you know, a renal cell carcinoma or something that that you either could still see without contrast or that was missed? So of these 201 patients, 49% of them had a primary diagnosis identified on CT scan. So that's kind of an interesting number to think about in general. Like if I have a patient in the emergency room with acute abdominal pain, about half the time I send them for a CT scan with contrast, I'm going to find a primary diagnosis that explains it. That's an interesting number. 8% had actionable secondary diagnoses, and then 46% had no primary or actionable secondary diagnoses. So when they pooled all of the different numbers for each physician reading the scans, the overall pooled accuracy, including primary and secondary diagnoses, was 70%. So unenhanced CT scan was 30 percentage points less accurate than contrast enhanced CT scan for identifying all primary and secondary diagnoses. If you broke it down by faculty versus residents and you're looking at just primary diagnoses, so faculty actually did a pretty good job. 90% of the time they were able to still see the primary cause of or the primary diagnosis. They were less likely to miss a finding, but they were more likely to identify false positives than the residents, which is interesting. So they're more likely to kind of add something that's not there. When they looked at a multivariable regression, faculty had 82% accuracy for primary diagnosis compared to 75% for residents. Faculty had 87% accuracy for secondary diagnoses compared to 90% for residents. And that's because they had a higher false positive rate. So the false positives that they identified were things like pancreatitis, bowel perforation, diverticulitis, pyelonephritis, neoplasia. Like residents were less likely to call those things. And so they actually had better accuracy on the secondary, that was on the primary diagnosis. Faculty mm-hmm. had a lower false negative rate, so 38% versus 62%. The false negatives were for things like vascular dissection, hemoperitoneum, so things where you really need contrast, you know, if there's bleeding, infection, and neoplasia. So interestingly, they say that 16 of the studies were misinterpreted by all six radiologists. So they missed all of the primary diagnoses and all of the secondary diagnoses for these 16 studies. And 94% of those studies had a primary diagnosis. But unfortunately, in the paper, they do not include what those diagnoses are, because I would love to know what every single person missed when the study didn't have contrast. So I think my take-home message for this paper is that for most patients, it's not even, well, I shouldn't say it's not worth doing. if you're not going to do it with IV contrast, there's a significant chance you're going to miss what you're looking for. And so I think that should really enter your calculus for, you know, whether or not you're going to use contrast or not. You know, in the patient who has poor renal function, I say just give the CT with contrast because you need to find that primary diagnosis. If someone has had a mild hypersensitivity reaction in the past, load them up with the prednisone and the Benadryl and all of the protocols so that you can still give contrast, right? Like, do everything you can to still be able to give your patient contrast if it's going to be a critical diagnosis. But obviously there are still some patients you just can't give contrast to, and you're still going to find that primary diagnosis, you know, 70 to 90% of the time. So
I think it's an interesting study. I mean, when I was my first year attending, I think I remember someone telling me, one of the nephrologists that I work with, you know, I can replace the kidneys if you need, which I'm not trying to be sort of flippant about dialysis, but the comment was, if someone has an AKI and you are worried about contrast-induced nephropathy, whether you believe it or not is a thing, you know, if you need a contrast, if you need a CT scan, get it with contrast because it's probably more accurate. And I thought, wow, that's a very interesting way of putting it. So I feel like this study helps validate it about, you know, are we willing to accept a 30 percentage point decrease in diagnostic accuracy? And what is the sort of risk and harm? So I feel a lot more comfortable in my retrospectively in my decisions to put people through the tube of truth, as we call it. And it also makes me feel a lot better about, you know, when I feel like I can't give someone, they have a severe contrast allergy and I really feel like I need contrast of their abdomen or something like that. And I say, well, you know, I really worry about, should we get an MRI with contrast because they can receive gadolinium, but they can't receive contrast for some reason. It makes me feel a little bit better going for that, in a way, because I feel like, well, am I really willing to miss this? So very interesting. Also sort of secondarily reinforces me saying, okay, always go back and make sure you look at the attending attestation for radiology studies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the residents were pretty good in this study.
Very good. Yeah.
And these were senior residents, right? They were seasoned, they'd been around, but the faculty still, you know, were a little bit better at the primary diagnosis. That's a good point. So, I think that's all we've got for tonight. So thanks so much, Dr. Hoppenfeld, for joining us to talk about these papers. And thank you to all our listeners for sticking around this long. And we'll see you next time.